The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
They're armed and staying put. A group of protesters broke into an unoccupied
armed, self-styled militiamen are occupying the Malheur National
by a group of activists protesting the federal prosecution of two ranchers.
The armed occupation broke off from a peaceful rally earlier in the
clips
day.
Clips there from CNN, Reuters, and the Associated Press, all covering the takeover of an Oregon wildlife refuge by anti-government activists, which is continuing this week. Or wait, should we call them a militia or domestic terrorists or armed protesters? Is this a protest or is it a standoff? Well, news outlets are struggling with how to identify the group occupying a federal wildlife management office in eastern Oregon, along with what exactly the group is doing. It's a dilemma for traditional journalism that Paul Fahre outlines in his Washington Post article, Terrorists, Freedom Fighters, Oregon Standoff Poses Quandary for Media. And Paul, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
Well, you know, in your conversations with editors at newspapers and other major news outlets who are wrestling with the question about how to describe the situation in Oregon, what are some of the things that they told you that they were wrestling with or trying to avoid?
One of the things that they're wrestling with is how to describe who these people are and what their cause is. And you get into a very fraught area once you do that. Do you call them activists? Do you call them protesters? Do you call them terrorists? We so far have rejected the word terrorist because it does not appear that their intent is to terrorize, which would seem to be the basic reason to use that word. The other question might be, how do you describe what their politics are? That's not entirely clear either, because they haven't exactly said, we are conservatives, we are ultra-conservatives, we are far-right conservatives, or whatever they might be. So it would be our imposition of our own thoughts on them to make such judgments. And so far, I think most of the mainstream media, at least, has withheld trying to characterize the politics of this and just say, here is their cause, here is what they say, in their own words, and that's what we'll leave it at that.
What about the 150 armed men now occupying this office? What are they calling themselves?
You know, that's a very good question. They, the leader of the group, a fellow named Eamon Bundy, has said, we're not terrorists. He's also said that they're not militiamen. Militia does have a strict definition. It also has a general definition. And these guys don't really quite fit that definition. A militia, more or less, is an organized group. Part of an armed force for a country, and it has a semi-official kind of consideration. That's not what these guys are. This is just a loose confederation of people who feel that there's a grievance and they want to protest. And so militia doesn't fit. Group protesters, you name it, it gets very kind of anodyne and boring. But again, once you start choosing other adjectives or other labels, you start taking sides, and that's not what we want to do.
Well, there's a big distinction here between traditional media outlets and the language posted on social media. So what's the responsibility of news media in a case like this when you have, you know, people throwing around terms like terrorism or freedom fighters online?
Well, social media is each individual's choice. They're not obligated to any professional standard of behavior or of conduct, whereas journalists presumably are. We try, again, to cast things in just as basic a factual light as we can. Let the reader, let the viewer, let the listener come up with their own conclusion. The idea is always to take us and our opinion out of it and let others come up with their own opinion. The conclusions on social media are inevitable and natural. People feel very strongly about this story, but we're supposed to be dispassionate. We're supposed to not be on anyone's side.
Your colleague, the Washington Post reporter Janelle Ross, is questioning publicly why the media is not using more charged terminology like revolt or insurgents or terrorism, when those terms would almost certainly be applied to a similar group of African Americans, she says, who occupied a federal building to protest police violence, or a group of Muslim Americans. What do you think?
Well, with all respect to her, I think she's wrong about that. We have described the people in Ferguson, the people in Baltimore who were protesting as protesters. We didn't call them criminals. We didn't call them thugs. We didn't attempt to diminish them or label them. We certainly described what they did and what their protest was all about, but we never started throwing labels around. The opinion that she gave on in her column is not one that news reporters would share. And that's the difference that is a bit subtle, but it's the difference between a columnist and a news reporter. News reporters are trained to see the world in as neutral a fashion as they can possibly get. Columnists want to tell you what to think, and she's telling you what to think. That's not the job of a reporter, though.
You talked earlier about the decision to avoid the term terrorism because there isn't an apparent wish to terrorize an entire population. So what would it take for major news organizations to call it terrorism? What would have to happen?
I think the events that haven't occurred would have to occur. There would have to be some kind of violence. There would have to be violence in the name of the cause. There would have to be an outreach to the community to cause fear in the community. If you look at Paris, if you look at San Bernardino, those were events in which the acts committed were intended to frighten people, and that was the main purpose of what happened. That's not clear in this case that anybody's trying to frighten anyone. They certainly have a cause that they're committed to, but there's been no violence, and it's not clear that it will come to violence. And even if it does come to violence, that doesn't necessarily make it terrorism either. So, I mean, we get into kind of narrow definitional things about this. Look, I mean, I understand that people disagree with what they're doing. I've got my own personal thoughts on that as well, but we do try to follow some kind of standard of definitions of words before we start slinging them around. I'd also say that, you know, columnists are not obligated to do that. I mean, they can use any word they want. People on social media can use any word they want, of course. This is the standards of, you know, straight-up news reporting. But I understand within even a news organization there are differing standards, and it becomes very confusing to readers or viewers or listeners. Like, where are you coming from? Are you a columnist? Are you a reporter? Are you a blogger? It all gets very confusing, and it all gets very blurry to the average person on the receiving end of this.
Well, Paul Fahrey, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Paul Fahrey covers media for The Washington Post. He is very clear on the journalistic imperative to use unbiased language when covering events, and that news consumers consider the source of reporting or opinion. His colleague, Janelle Ross, is not alone in charging that media and police were slow to respond to the takeover in Oregon and would be responding much differently if a government building were occupied by Black or Muslim armed protesters. The hashtags Vanilla ISIS, Y'al-Qaeda, Yihadists, and Oregon Under Attack are highlighting disparities with tweets like this from Roland S. Martin. Did I miss the call for the National Guard in Oregon? I recall them in Ferguson and Baltimore. Moody tweeted, 12-year-old with toy, gunned down within 2.3 seconds. 150 armed men take over a federal building, barely a peep. Meanwhile, a meme showing Black men smashing shop windows in Baltimore side by side with the Oregon protesters mostly in cowboy hats, standing around with signs and flags, points to what that poster says is the liberal media bias. Someone under the handle Freddington tweeted, "Not sure the best reaction from the left is a burst of online bigoted stereotypes about rural white people. Y'al-Qaeda, ahem." Kelsey shared her thoughts. "It's absolutely disgusting that the left is calling the Oregon men Y'al-Qaeda. You can't compare these men to murderous terrorists." Well, we'd like to know what you think of the coverage. Is there a double standard for reporting on the standoff with armed protesters in Oregon and demonstrations or threats by non-white actors? How do you think the media should refer to the group? As militiamen, armed protesters, anti-government activists? Well, let us know what you think on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Parsing the distinction between a pundit, a columnist, and reporter may be difficult in the social media age, where points of view are shared on Facebook and Twitter unburdened by journalistic ethics or accountability. Well, there is one editorial tradition clearly meant to influence opinions, the political cartoon. In 1884, Republican presidential candidate James G. Blaine was running against his Democratic rival Grover Cleveland. Blaine was a charismatic contender, but one well known for being corrupt. Cleveland had a great reputation, but had also fathered a child out of wedlock. Producer Emily Gaddick tells us how political cartoons played a crucial role in that election.
In June of 1884, Republicans gathered in Chicago's Exposition Hall to choose their candidate for president. Up on stage, James G. Blaine's supporters were painting a picture of him as a dignified statesman. But a very different image was being passed around the convention hall by Blaine's rivals.
Blaine, in fact, was caricatured as a freak in a circus.
This is Mark Summers, a historian at the University of Kentucky. He says the image was hard to forget. In vivid color, it showed Blaine cowering in his underwear before a crowd, his body covered in scandalous tattoos.
And being unveiled before the Republican tribunal like a blushing prostitute there, with all of his sins, all of his grafts, all of his crookedness, all tattooed on him. Blaine was, of course, furious, and he thought of suing the magazine, but he realized if he did that, this picture would circulate even wider and everyone would know of him as the tattooed man.
The cartoon came straight from the pages of Puck magazine, America's first successful humor publication. Think Mad Magazine, but with a lot more jokes about tariff reform. It was the brainchild of an Austrian immigrant named Joseph Kepler.
Joseph Kepler, the lead artist there, was, you know, probably one of the greatest cartoonists that America has ever had.
Before Puck, most political cartoons were drawn in black and white. They ran in serious news magazines like Harper's Weekly. Puck was different. Its cartoons came wrapped in pages of humorous essays and silly jokes, and it was one of the first magazines that printed in color, with bright covers and sprawling cartoon centerfolds. For first-time readers, it was like that moment from The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy emerges from black-and-white Kansas into color-filled Munchkin Land. But it also packed a punch.
Puck was, you know, a brilliant, frothy piece of work. It made fun of canting and pious and hypocritical ministers. It mocked the big businesses and the monopolies. And it took after Blaine with the most savage artist's crayon and savage colors you found.
Puck ran a tattooed man cartoon pretty much every week, turning Blaine's corrupt reputation into a central issue of the campaign. And that made Blaine's supporters nervous. So they approached a rival humor magazine called Judge, hoping to shift the focus to Democratic candidate Grover Cleveland's scandalous personal life.
Puck was so influential, so powerful, that the Republican Party decided they needed to have their own cartoon voice, and they began to pour money into Judge, because it was the only way you could make an answer to Puck. You know, you can answer an editorial easily with another editorial, but you can't answer a picture with an editorial. The only way you can respond to pictures is with other pictures.
Unfortunately for Republicans, Judge spent far more time attacking rival cartoonists than going after Cleveland. Cartoon historian Richard West says that even when they focused on the politics, they just couldn't keep up with Puck.
Every time they did a cartoon where they show Blaine, they were still using the tattooed man motif, and they tried to turn it on its head and show Blaine with tattoos like statesman and leader on his chest instead of the names of scandals he had been involved in. It was a subtle recognition, or maybe not so subtle recognition, that Puck had kind of already won the battle.
Cleveland won his battle, too. He squeaked into office and publicly credited Puck with handing him the election, which is kind of a big deal. Just imagine President Obama thanking Saturday Night Live for getting him elected with those relentless Sarah Palin skits. The election put Puck on the map. The magazine's circulation soared, and the staff moved into a huge new building in New York City. And a new crop of Puckish humor magazines even sprung up across the country.
There are dozens and dozens of imitators of Puck, but none of them ever surpassed Puck in its style and its wit and its the beauty of its cartoons.
Humor magazines weren't the only copycats. Puck had also shown newspapers that satire could sell. By the end of the 1884 election, editorial cartoons were splashed across the front pages of New York City's daily papers. They weren't as captivating or as colorful as Puck's, but that didn't matter.
The point was the political cartoon had finally migrated to the daily newspaper, and it would never go back.
As newspaper cartoons grew bigger and brighter, they gradually eclipsed Puck. The magazine finally folded in 1918, but its playful spirit lived on as the cartoonists who'd drawn for Puck in its heyday went on to draw the Sunday funnies and front page editorials for newspaper men like Hearst and Pulitzer.
They really are the creators of the legacy where political cartoonings are a daily experience, a daily event for a lot of us, and not cartoons to make us angry and to make us hate, but to make us laugh. And that in American history and cartooning is really very, very new.
And that piece was produced by Emily Gaddick for Backstory with the American History Guys. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. For the rest of the show, we're going to be talking about some of the big science stories coming up in 2016. But before that, we want to look back at one of the big science stories of 2004, one that did not go exactly as planned. Producer Lawrence Young brings us the story.
Have you ever wondered how much things are actually worth? Well, some things are worth a lot more than their weight in gold.
So the most valuable baseball card ever. Oh, per gram still?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. A baseball card is probably about 5 grams, and let's say it's $5 million, so $1 million a gram.
Gold, by comparison, is only about $50 a gram. Diamonds, up to $80,000 a gram. But there's something that makes gold, diamonds, and even baseball cards seem utterly worthless.
Let's go in round numbers. 2.4 times 10 to the 8 dollars.
That's $240 million.
Divided by 4 times 10 to the 17 atoms.
Together, those atoms weigh about as much as a speck of dust, making its price a staggering $4 trillion a gram.
Wow!
That's trillion with a T. So, what on earth is it?
Material being blown off the surface of the sun.
These are literally pieces of our sun. They're what make the northern lights glow. Here's a quick tutorial on how to get some for yourself.
You launch a spacecraft, you send it part of the way toward the sun.
Park it somewhere for about 2 years, collecting whatever comes along, and then bring it back. That's not quite as easy as it sounds, though, because those atoms have to be collected on ultra-high purity materials that are sensitive to even a bumpy landing.
The plan involved a Hollywood stunt pilot, and as the spacecraft parachuted back to the Earth, he would come up from behind with the helicopter, which had a hook, and would snag the parachute. Unfortunately, he never got the chance with Genesis. The parachute didn't open. The thing fell from space, and all the ultra-high purity materials were broken and scattered all over the desert floor.
For the Genesis mission, the stakes were high, too.
The sort of basic goal of Genesis was to understand the initial stuff of the solar system by actually getting a piece of the sun and measuring that.
You know that phrase that goes, "We are stardust, we are golden"? Well, in more ways than one, Genesis showed us just what we're made of.
You could literally pick up the pieces and you could form Plan B And in fact, some of the pieces survived okay, and we were able to make some measurements on those.
Of course, there's the $4 trillion question.
Is it worth it, or was it worth it?
Well, yeah, I think absolutely, because, I mean, although, you know...
Maybe we should be asking a different question.
If you walked up to someone and said,
right,
I've got some of the solar wind, how much are they going to pay you, you think?
Not very much is the answer. I mean, it's.
I mean, I think that's not the way to measure the cost of that mission. If you don't tell people about the results of Genesis, then it's worthless, you know?
Yeah, in comparison to things like...
a baseball card.
Yeah.
And that story was produced by Lawrence Young.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among a lot of recaps about the year that was, each year, popular science looks forward to the year to come, highlighting some of the big ideas that could be game changers in science and technology and the environment, health, space, and the military. Whether it be the inevitability of killer robots used in warfare, providing internet access to billions who cannot yet get online, or researching how environmental pollution today can infect generations to come. All sorts of big ideas. And Cliff Ransom is editor-in-chief here to talk about some of the big ideas covered in the January-February issue of Popular Science. Cliff, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So there are millions of ideas that, of course, circulate each year. How do you and your staff focus and pick them?
Boy, that's a really tough question. I mean, we start this process months in advance, looking at the trends that are happening, talking to the writers that are out there, talking to people in industry and science and technology. And slowly we start to winnow this very big list down to the topics and trends that we think are going to be talked about in 2016 or 2017.
Well, let's get to some science. In the science department, CRISPR, this is the inexpensive, highly accurate, fast editing gene editing program that could put the ability to change genetic makeup at a consumer level. And we've been hearing about it for some time. Why do you think its time has come?
You know, CRISPR was basically discovered in 2012. And I think it's on the short list as a Nobel Prize candidate, or the scientists who developed it will get a Nobel Prize in 2016. But more to the point, I think after 3 years of trying to figure out what CRISPR is and how it can be used, a lot of people have locked on to it. And we're seeing a lot of different startups being formed around that technology. The number of patents that are being filed in relation to that technology are going way up. And we believe that there's going to be sort of a burst of commercial activity around CRISPR, whether that is developing gene therapies or developing new forms of plants or, you know, other agricultural products or animals. There's a lot that can be done when you harness the power of gene editing. And we believe that that, by and large, is a force for good.
So I know that a group of scientists recently expressed some concerns about releasing it to the public. Do you think that's kind of inevitable at this point?
I do. I think that the technology is out there. It's well documented. Anybody can access it. Granted, you sort of have to be a cell biologist to really take advantage of it. But I don't think that there's any stopping that technology from being out there. It's already here.
Now, moving on to your big ideas in the technology department, using artificial intelligence to, I guess, pull meaning from satellite imagery. First, tell us what that means and what are some practical applications?
Sure. This was an interview that we did with a fellow by the name of James Crawford. He launched a startup called Orbital Insight. And effectively what Orbital Insight does is it creates something called the macroscope. So we all know what a microscope is. It revolutionized biology by allowing us to look at the very small. What the macroscope does is it allows us to look at the very big. Hmm. And that means that we can use artificial intelligence to see great detail across great distances in a way that the human eye never could. And by doing that, we develop all sorts of interesting data, and we can draw meaning from that data that, you know, allows us to make predictions about crop yields, allows us to mitigate deforestation, all sorts of things.
Well, of course, one big interesting idea coming up is in the military realm, the idea of killer robots. I found it interesting. You quote a computer scientist at Berkeley who predicted that lethal autonomous weapons will become what he called the Kalashnikovs of tomorrow. So first, what are lethal autonomous weapons and how close are they to being used in warfare?
Boy, that's a great question. First off, autonomous weapons are sort of what they sound. They're weapons that can make decisions on their own. So a gun that can decide on its target and can decide on when to fire. A missile that could do the same, for example. Now, that sounds very science fiction. It sounds very Terminator. But the reality is that at this point, our command of artificial intelligence systems has grown to a point that the idea of AI weaponry is not so far off. In fact, the scientist that we talked to, Stuart Russell from University of California, Berkeley, he thinks that a motivated nation state could build one of these weapons in 18 months or less.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a really big deal. And that's in part why you hear people like Elon Musk and Steve Wozniak from, you know, the co-founder of Apple, Stephen Hawking, coming out and saying, hey, we need to temper our enthusiasm around artificial intelligence. They have other reasons as well, but AI weapons and AI weaponry is a big part of it. So what Stewart is working toward is a preemptive ban on AI weaponry, which would head off kind of an AI weapons arms race.
Well, let's look at something a little less frightening. In space, 2015, of course, an exciting year for space exploration. So many people watched the New Horizons probe pass Pluto in the summer. And popular science predicts a second act for space exploration in 2016. That was surprising to me, since you highlight what NASA has in store, not these private space ventures we've heard so much about. So what is coming up?
Boy, there's a whole bunch coming up in 2016 that we're really excited about. One of them, of course, is the NASA InSight probe. So that's going to be launching in March. That's going to establish a seismic station on Mars. And what that means is that we're going to be looking at geologic activity, seismic activity on the red planet in an attempt to better understand the geology of the planet, how that planet started, you know, what the sort of internal mechanics of that planet look like. The fun thing about the InSight probe is that it's also going to be outfitted with a couple CubeSats. So these are these little satellites that have become quite popular here on Earth, whether with governments, universities, or with individuals. These little satellites can be purpose-built to take measurements, to communicate, and we're going to have a couple of them that launch with the InSight probe, and then we'll go into orbit around Mars. And our hope and our expectation is that will be sort of the first of many, you know, that launch of CubeSats will be the first of many. And we're going to see more and more people putting satellites around Mars to really bear down and figure out what Mars has in store.
Cliff Ransom is with us. He's the editor-in-chief of Popular Science. And each year they come out with a big ideas issue, highlighting some of the things we're probably going to be hearing a lot more about in the coming year. Of course, back down here on Earth, health is a big concern for a lot of people. And there's a lot of research going on into how light that we use in homes and offices and buildings could be doing us harm. What does that mean going forward?
Well, it turns out that light bulbs have a dark side, you know, in a manner of speaking. If you think about it, light has a profound effect on many of the, you know, animals that live on this planet. This is a primordial physiological response. And in humans, red light makes us sleepy, blue light makes us awake. So that all worked fine. That was part of the natural cycle. And then Edison came in with his light bulb, sort of changed the system. And so for the last 100, or I guess it would be more like 130, 140 years, we have been living in an artificial system, at least in terms of light. And scientists are beginning to figure out that that has some deleterious effects. Obesity, diabetes, all sorts of different things can happen when your hormones get thrown out of whack. Not to say that that's the only reason for obesity or diabetes, of course, but it can be a contributing factor. So what scientists want to do now is turn back the clock, as it were. They want to create light bulbs that follow the natural cycle, that change from red to blue at certain times to modify either people's behavior or put them more closely in line with the natural cycle.
Wow, it's fascinating stuff. Of course, the influence of our environment on us is huge. And one thing I found fascinating in your big ideas is how environmental pollution could be influencing not just who we are today and, you know, asthma or drinking bad water and heavy metals, but actually altering genetic makeup and causing disease. So what's going on in this field?
This is a field that's really taking off right now, and it's the field of epigenomics. So a quick clarification there. If genomics and your DNA is kind of what gives you brown hair and brown eyes or whatnot, the epigenome is the thing that causes that DNA to turn on and off. So it's the mechanism by which genes express, more or less. And what people have figured out is that environmental chemicals can affect that epigenome and therein affect the expression of genes. Now, we've known about this for a while. In fact, last February, I guess it was, we completed a full map of the epigenome, similar to the Human Genome Project.
Hmm.
But only recently have we figured out that epigenomic effects, as in environmental effects, can be passed down from generation to generation to generation. So, for example, if you lock yourself in a room with a bunch of diesel, there will actually be an effect on your genes. Certain genes will turn on, certain genes will turn off. Now, I'm simplifying it a little bit, but that's more or less the case.
That's so interesting because, you know, now we look at history and family history of cancer or diabetes or other kinds of diseases. This could actually be environmentally induced?
It could be. You know, again, the understanding, it's at the very beginning stages, which is why we're saying, you know, 2016, we're going to be hearing a lot more about it. But indications are such that, yes, environmental pollution could be an inherited disease.
Wow. Cliff, before we wrap up, any big ideas you feel like we missed out on that stand out to you?
Boy, that's sort of like, you know, asking me which child do I like the most. You know, I think that we covered a lot of it. If there was one that I really love, and it's kind of a sleeper in the package, it's the year of the zettabyte in 2016. The year of the zettabyte. So by the end of 2016, Cisco estimates that internet traffic at any given point will reach the zettabyte level. So
how do we even conceive of that?
It's a huge number. So basically, a zettabyte is 1,000 exabytes. And again, that doesn't mean a whole lot. So that translates into 1 trillion gigabytes. And even that doesn't mean a whole lot. So imagine it as 300 trillion photos of, you know, your family Christmas. So that's a lot of data. And obviously, that shows that people are coming online in greater numbers. And that's a by and large, a very good thing. But it also has sort of a downside, too. The more data that's out there, the more subject to hacking attacks and those sorts of things will be. So in 2016, I think we're going to see this continuation of the same dynamic that we've seen in past years, but probably at a little bit intenser level. We're going to see more hacking attacks, and we're going to see a greater move across the web toward encryption and protections for consumers, for enterprises, and so on.
Almost incomprehensible. Thank you so much for going through some of those big ideas with us today.
Great. Well, thank you.
Cliff Ransom, he's editor-in-chief of Popular Science, and you'll find a link to look at all of their Big Ideas 2016 issue. It's the January-February issue online. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The technology for selecting genes for certain attributes, say gender or green eyes, and for eradicating diseases from cystic fibrosis to Huntington's disease exists right now. But late last year, scientists and ethicists from around the world met to discuss gene editing and agreed that it would be irresponsible to begin creating gene-modified babies until the safety and desirability of these kind of procedures can be established. There are huge questions remaining about genetic modification, much of it focused on a new technology called CRISPR. Now, we just heard from Cliff Ransom about how companies are buzzing about the commercial opportunities for CRISPR, which has already brought the cost of modifying genetic material down to the consumer level. Antonio Regalado is biomedicine editor for MIT Technology Review, where he reported on the International Summit on Human Gene Editing that was held last month in Washington. Antonio, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
This is a very complicated technology, but can you run through CRISPR for us in sort of layperson's terms?
Sure. CRISPR is a sort of a newly invented technology. It was discovered in bacteria, and basically it's a pair of molecular scissors. It's very cheap and easy to use, and it can be pointed at any strand of DNA that scientists choose, and they can cut it. They can change the DNA letters. They can edit it, and it's really extremely inexpensive to use. Doing a CRISPR experiment, just the materials, the scissors, so to speak, is only about $60.
So is CRISPR being used now?
CRISPR is being used just about everywhere in laboratories for all kinds of experiments, to make genetically modified mice, to study cancer. It's a very important tool that is just fundamental to biological research these days. Of course, it also raises some interesting questions that we're going to get into.
Well, the debate over gene modification quickly turns into an uproar over the potential for designer babies. First, what kind of traits potentially can be altered in eggs and sperm and embryos, what you refer to as germline editing?
Right. Well, of course, there's a lot of inherited diseases, sickle cell anemia, beta thalassemia, Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis, the list goes on. There's several thousand of these inherited diseases. And that's one thing scientists are thinking about. They're thinking, well, what if we could edit out these genes and so they're not passed on to the next generation of people?
Are there any other potential uses for CRISPR gene editing technologies?
There are, and that's where people start to get worried. You could use this technology to install genes in people that protect them from disease, make them taller, give them blue eyes. This is the whole area of enhancement, and for the most part, this is an idea that scares people and that most scientists think that we shouldn't get into.
So the debate at the International Summit focused on correcting these disease-causing genes. What were the kind of arguments against going forward with using it in this way?
The arguments against going forward were basically three. One is that it's a long way from being proved really safe to do. Lots of animal research could be done before we'd ever try it in people. A second argument, which is kind of an argument against the medical use of the technology, is that for the most part, if you have in your family an inherited disease, there's other ways to get around that. You don't need to use gene editing. And then the third counterargument is basically this argument against enhancement that we shouldn't get into changing people to make them better. That's eugenics, and that's wrong, and we shouldn't do that.
So who was arguing that it should be used as soon as possible, even with those three points not quite answered?
Well, at this particular summit, it was really dominated by the geneticists and scientists who've developed the tools. And so they didn't really hear from doctors, but sort of outside the main sessions, if you did talk to patient and patient advocates, they were much more gung-ho about the idea of using gene editing. They have the problematic genes, and they really have much less of a problem with the idea of changing the sequence. so that they can have healthy children and don't have to worry about these kinds of problems in the future.
Right. And I've seen many arguments online that people, you know, who carry genes for pediatric leukemia or cystic fibrosis that could severely disable children, they say, okay, curing these diseases is worth anything that can be done in the way of, you know, designer babies. What's the counter argument for that?
The main counter argument is that it's not absolutely necessary to do. There's another technology that's used in IVF clinics. It's called PGD, for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And basically, when there's a 4 or 8 cell embryo that they've made in the IVF clinic, they can suck off just one cell and they can do a genetic test. And most of these inherited diseases are passed down to only 50% of the embryo. So you, in the IVF clinic, you can simply select the healthy ones. So there's no reason for gene editing. That's the major argument against it.
So it's already being done?
The selection is already being done using diagnostics, absolutely.
But not this very efficient and potentially very inexpensive tool of CRISPR. You use in one of your articles a very chilling term, consumer eugenics. As the capacity for this becomes cheaper, aren't market forces much more likely to overrun any hesitation or any regulation?
Yeah, that is possible. I think people who study eugenics, they're looking back basically at you know, abuses of eugenics by state actors, right? The Commonwealth of Virginia sterilized women. Of course, then there's the Nazis. So it was sort of always the state that was the problem. But here in the world we live in, there's this demand by patients or consumers for these technologies. And so people fear what will happen if the free market is allowed to decide how it gets used. People might use it for purposes that other people disagree with.
And on the international market, I mean, there was a big break this past spring when a team in China announced it had successfully altered a gene for an inherited disease. Now, this, by the way, is research that could not have been done in the U.S. with any federal funding. So even if this international summit concludes, you know, we're not moving forward with this, can there be any realistic expectation of compliance?
That's a good question. China is a very big place, and there's a lot going on. So it's hard to know, first of all, what's happening, and second of all, really, what the motivations are. Personally, I'm not inclined to believe the sort of threat that the Chinese will go ahead and make super people. But it's a little bit hard to tell. The summit in Washington was really an attempt to corral the three countries that are most important in the research, is China, the United States, and the United Kingdom, and get them to agree, or the leading scientists to agree, and put out this statement to basically discourage anybody from doing it. Whether that will work or not, it's hard to tell.
So where does it go to next? This was the first meeting of this particular group. Did it turn up the burner on this question?
Well, I think everybody can kind of relax for maybe a year or 2 years. I don't think anything is going to happen medically with this technology in that time period. However, it's likely that eventually some doctor will step forward and say that they need to help a patient with this technology, and then the issue will come to the fore again. Certainly the members of the committee at the summit plan many more meetings and are trying to establish a dialogue that would involve the whole world and not just these three powerful CRISPR countries.
Antonio, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you very much.
Antonio Regalado, he's editor for MIT Technology Review, and you'll find a link to read all of his articles on gene editing. Link is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can just go to wordofmouthradio.org. There's a deep list of segments to listen to, post on social media, or email to your friends. We do find the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you to keep sharing them with word of mouth from NHPR.